In this episode, episode 47 of the Daily Hustle, we talk about making a change in your business, why growth pain is good. We also discuss questionable marriage type situations, and also Marshall has to fire Derek.
Broadcasting from the Box That Rocks and Thrive15.com world headquarters, it's the Daily Hustle with Daniel McKenna.
Welcome, folks, into episode 47 of the Daily Hustle Show. As always, to my left, Marshall F. Morris, sitting over there. Over here, Daniel McKenna. And today is episode 47. We are talking about making change in your business and why growth pain is good. This is going to be a multiple episode series talking about making change in your business and why growth pain is good. Marshall, you're 6'7". You've had some growth pain.
Growth pain hurts.
Growth pain, but it was good. You're tall.
So I guess that's inherently good.
Yeah. I mean, it has nothing to do with business, but I'm just, kind of making a correlation there. By the way, episode 47. This is the Andre Kirilenko episode.
Who's that?
He is the first Russian player drafted in NBA history. Okay. Played the Utah Jazz for a long time. Played the Nets. Turned down a $10 million offer to go to the Timberwolves. Instead, took a $3 million offer to play at the Nets. The owner was a Russian guy. All the NBA owners were like, something fishy's going on here.
He's the only guy.
He just turned down $7
million. He's the only guy that could, they could understand each other.
AK-47. Named an all-star in 2004. Three-time first-team all-defense selection. And famously, he's married to a Russian pop star who gives him a hall pass once a year. I don't know that's good like marriage advice necessarily. Maybe the culture is different in Russia than it is here. I don't know. But yeah, once a year, he's allowed to cheat on her. She's like, it's cool. I don't get that really. But I mean, that's notable.
That's true. Sam's losing it over there.
Sam's dying behind the camera. Yeah, so there you go. And Andre Kirilenko.
I can't really provide much commentary on that.
That's fair. Today, Marshall, we are going to be getting into managing change in your business. And we're going to read some case studies. We're going to read some case studies of some big businesses that have had change.
A lot of this is going to come from a book called The Service Profit Chain.
Service Profit Chain.
It is a Harvard case study, and it's written by Heskett and Sasser. Okay, and so it's going to be hugely valuable as we dive into this, and it's honestly one of my favorite books because there is so much good stuff. Now, it's dense. It's a dense book.
Mm.
So
it floats.
Yeah.
Is that what that means?
No.
Okay.
But
I thought that meant it float.
No.
Okay.
It's dense. That joke was so much better than the one I had. but Dan, how often does major change need to happen in a business, or how often does it happen, or how often does it need to happen in a business based on what we're learning about here?
Well, we're talking about strategic decisions for the business, and we're going to read some case studies here for you and then dive into all the specifics. So this is going to be a multiple episode series here. But basically talking about as the world changes, as your business operates and continues moving forward, the strategic decisions you have to make along the way to keep up and to keep growing is what we're talking about here. So here's a quote from Bloomberg. Bloomberg says that constant change is a business reality, and organizations must continually adapt to their environments to stay competitive or risk becoming obsolete. That is why the ability to incorporate big changes into the DNA of an enterprise while driving operating results is a much sought after competency. Saying if you can figure out how to change your business while also delivering the results you need, that's something that people are looking for. They're looking for that skill set. For instance, let's say you went crazy and did all the SEO you needed for your business in 1 week, all week long. You did all the SEO, got to the top of Google. At some point, you probably still need to do some more SEO, or at some point, you probably also need to run some ads. Like, that doesn't mean like you're done.
Mm.
Maybe later on down the line, maybe. What if Google wasn't like the big thing 10 years from now? Then what? Right? We're talking about strategic changes in your business. Okay? For instance, maybe a business that didn't change in time, didn't adapt in time, Blockbuster.
I'm going to go ahead and say definitively.
Blockbuster.
Did not change in time.
Did not see the wave coming. Did not see the Netflix wave coming. Now there's also Amazon Prime. There's also Hulu. Like, it became the thing. You watch your stuff online. You don't go to the store and rent stuff.
That's right.
Redbox had those dollar rentals for older movies.
Yeah.
Blockbuster got crushed. Borders. Borders, big bookstore. So Borders decides to make a huge investment in CD and DVD sales. You ever been to a Borders?
Yeah, I have, or used to.
Used to? You know how they used to have like 20% of the store was like CDs and movies and stuff?
Yeah.
Made a huge investment in that just as the world was going digital. They're like, that's it. We're going to sell CDs and DVDs. And the rest of the world said, we're going to go digital.
My goodness. We can. Everybody's selling these dirt cheap. This is a great opportunity for us.
That's right. And they decided, we'll outsource our online sales to Amazon. Amazon's already got the process built. We're going to outsource our... Well, it turns out it did not work out for Borders that way. They shut down all their stores, I believe, back in 2011. While Barnes & Noble, their strategic move was to start beefing up their own online sales as opposed to get heavy into physical CDs and DVDs. Now, because of the wave of Amazon, Barnes & Noble is still struggling, but it's still alive. They don't have a lot of debt. They're going to make it through. As recently as September of 2016, they had a $15 million loss in that quarter. That was right after their CEO got booted from the company in what sounds like non-harmonious terms. So they're struggling, but they're still alive. They're not going to go anywhere anytime soon.
These are pretty big businesses.
These are big businesses. These are really big businesses.
So I would say most of the people, the majority of the people,
yeah.
There's probably a couple of people watching. Elon Musk is probably watching.
Elon Musk is probably watching right now asking, what changes should I make
Mark Cuban,
my Mars business?
Mark Cuban, he's probably watching.
Mark, what's up, man?
What are some of the changes that the majority of the people watching that own small businesses, what would be some of the changes that small businesses might need to make in order to reinvigorate them?
So our audience is obviously small business, medium-sized business owners and entrepreneurs. I can tell you from personal experience for the photography business, we had to make strategic decisions about how we were going to market. So for instance, we quit going and trying to work on relationships with like dress stores. Like we used to, at one point, used to have like a small little booth set up at a dress store. So when girls came in to look at their dresses, we could also talk to them about photography there. We decided that was not working because it wasn't really working. Instead, we put more focus on going out to venues, getting in touch with venues, getting vendor referrals that way, as well as SEO. We quit spending money on ads in like the Brides of Oklahoma magazine instead of sending money towards the knot.com. That's working great. We recently moved editors to a salary position instead of a project pay position. Because project pay meant summer, wedding season, they got paid tons of money. They're doing great. And then in winter, January, February, everybody was like starving. Everybody was like just trying to hold on to sweet life during that time period. So we took the average for the year, made it a salary position so that no one's going to starve, right? And it made the editors all happy, and now we're able to work and move forward as a team. So these are just some of the strategic decisions that we've made. And I'm sure there's strategic decisions like that that you've had to make in your business too, especially if you have a team. Especially if you have a team and it's not just you working on the business. There's probably many strategic decisions you made over the years to continue moving forward and trying new things to continue growing your business. So those are the sort of things we're talking about. But today we're going to start reading from some other big companies. And the reason we're going to give you two big companies here, well, one's a big company, one's more of a government entity. But the reason we're going to read these big stories is to give you context that this happens for everybody, right? As you continue moving forward, this is going to have to happen to you. The things that you need to be prepared for and the specifics on the way of what you need to do to make those huge organizational changes.
That's the hot sizzle.
That's the hot sizzle. Let's talk about the Taco Bell story, Marshall.
Yep.
Taco Bell story, John Martin, the CEO, 1988, the year is 1988.
Yep.
In a land long, long ago. at the time, Taco Bell was described as a Mexican ethnic fast food chain.
Okay.
Logo was a Mexican sleeping under a sombrero. Maybe not quite as PC, you know, I don't know if that'd be allowable now necessarily in but that's how it was then. The restaurant featured a large kitchen for on-site food preparation. So this is more of a restaurant, really. Like, they had a large kitchen. They made all the stuff there. 30% of the store was reserved for seating for customers. Like, it was more of a, like, a full-fledged restaurant, really.
Yeah.
That was trying to be a food chain, a fast food chain. Recording modest year-to-year sales and profit gains, but was not up to the standards of the parent company, PepsiCo.
Who else does PepsiCo work with?
Oh, man. It's a long list.
Okay. Pepsi?
Yes.
Okay.
That's one of them. Yeah, PepsiCo is the major shell.
I'm guessing PepsiCo owns Pepsi.
They do.
PepsiCo of Pepsi.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah, they own... There's a lot. So Taco Bell identified their ideal customer. We've talked about that in previous episodes, finding out who your ideal and likely buyers are. They were heavy fast food users seeking value. After a franchisee polled the HFFUs, they learned that the HFFUs wanted fact. We're using a lot of acronyms here, but I'm going to describe them all. Fact. They wanted fast food fast, accurate order fulfillment, cleanliness, and temperature control, meaning like hot food is hot, cold food is cold. They did not emphasize the need for a kitchen in the restaurant. Interesting. So they said, what are our ideal customers? What do they actually want? Well, this is what they want. This is what they care about. Turns out they don't really care about the kitchen. Interesting. So these two insights made Martin decide to change the 1,800 corporate-owned stores. There's 3,200 at the time. The rest of them were franchisees. And this is what they did. They decided to lower prices by over 25%. Just off the top. Just over 25%. Everything's over 25% cheaper now. We're going to appeal to our ideal and likely buyer who wants cheaper food. That's it. We now have cheaper food. With no change in quality, this meant that food costs went from 25% to 33% of sales. Taco Bell would have to squeeze 8 percentage points out of overhead costs out of the 13.6% it was experiencing, or dramatic increase in sales without increase in overhead. So 13.6% of their costs were overhead, and now they're like, we got to get that lowered by 8% or have dramatically more sales to make up for this. Because our move now is we're going to lower the prices by 25%.
Yeah. Strategically, we're going to increase sales by giving everybody forever 25% off.
Talk about that, Marshall. I don't know if this rings true with any of your clients necessarily, but talk about maybe the anxiety, maybe the fear, maybe the sort of emotions that come up when the top of the chain, the CEO, now says, all right, guys, we're not hitting sales numbers, so to make up for it, we're making everything cheaper by 25%.
Well, you have a couple ways that you can always grow a business. It's pretty simple. You can either increase sales or decrease expenses. So they go, okay, we're going to start by increasing sales. How are we going to do that? We're going to drop prices by 25%.
So they increase their expenses, essentially.
It's a
percentage-wise.
Percentage of expenses of sales. Of sales. So then they're like, well, we can't do that or else we're going to record a huge loss. So they're like, we have to figure out some kind of way to cut expenses or operate at such a large scale of more sales that we can make up for it.
So this all seems like normal life now. If you were ever to go in a Taco Bell now, this would seem totally normal because it was back in 1988. But over the next 2 years, they implemented K-minus, restaurants without kitchens. There's 1,800 stores, Marshall. They're like, that's it. We're ripping the kitchen out of all these 1,800 stores. Food preparation, except for final assembly and heating, was moved to centralized commissaries. So they had like kitchens that would make the food in central locations and then ship out the food to these Taco Bells who would put some final assembly together, heat it up, and give it to you.
That's right.
Which maybe you're the Whole Foods guy and you're like, that's gross. That's terrible. I can't believe they would do that. Or maybe you're the business guy and you're like, yeah, that's the move. That is the move. So I don't know which one you are at home. This made 70% of the restaurant table space instead of the 30%, Marshall. They redesigned their food delivery processes by assembling popular items in advance instead of making them to order, which sped up service during the busy lunch hour by 71%, increasing restaurant sales capacity by 54% during this time period. They basically moved all their food stuff out of the way, and it opened up a whole lot of more room and made things a lot faster when it was time to actually like give somebody some food. This convinced Taco Bell they could operate on carts and kiosks in airports and offices, Taco Bell's without walls, essentially, which greatly expanded what it began to refer to as points of access. They're making some moves here.
A lot of moves.
They're making a lot of moves here. Wage and bonus packages were increased to about 60% more than those of competitors to attract the kind of managers needed to accomplish the change. Wait, hang on a second. So their move, they're like, we're not selling enough stuff. And they say, what we need to do is rip out all the kitchens and make percentage-wise our expenses go up. And also, we need to pay people 60% more.
And give them benefits.
And give them benefits. These all seem like you better know what you're doing type moves. Like, these are big, big moves. They replaced three levels of middle management with a position called market manager, which would serve as consultants to as many as 20 restaurant general managers, twice as many as their predecessors, and could earn at least twice what their competitors offered for the same position. So they went with the whole a lot fewer people that are paid better move. Managers and employees were trained to spend less time on operating manners and more time on the front line with customers. And between 1989 and 1993, Taco Bell's sales increased rapidly, producing profit gains roughly three times those of its major competitors, and customer satisfaction increased each year.
Bang.
What are your thoughts on this whole thing, Marshall? I mean, this is a big move by John Martin and the team here to say, we're going to rip out kitchens, we're going to change the food costs, we're going to get rid of three levels of our management team, we're going to pay the ones that we do want 60%. Talk about that.
Well, in order to have big changes, okay, and adapt with the times, to have big gains, you got to have quite a bit of change. You got to, like, it's not just labeling people new titles. That's what I think, like, organizational change overhaul sometimes means to some companies.
You're not the district manager anymore. You're the regional manager.
Yeah. And nothing really changes.
No.
But, like, you can see change by no longer the kitchens being actually in the restaurant.
That's a large physical change.
That's a physical change that you can see. So they reap the reward of implementing and effectively executing the plan that they had set up for themselves with all this change.
Now, the good news here is it worked. Producing profits gains roughly three times those of its major competitors. Now Taco Bell is, I mean, like, you think of fast food, you think of McDonald's, Taco Bell. Like, it's like one of the big boys, right?
Yeah, Coney Island.
Coney Island. Marshall's Frankfurters. The big boys.
Yeah.
How about the growth pains, though? Training costs skyrocketed. Management roles changed quickly, and at least one in three of Taco Bell's best command and control managers left the organization.
They're like, yeah, not down for the cause.
A third of their best managers were like, can't do it.
I'm not interested.
You guys are crazy. This isn't going to work.
Too much work.
Don't want this new job.
No, thank you.
This was what transferred Taco Bell in from a, you know, middle of the road sort of trying to be fast food chain that's kind of more of a restaurant into a giant powerhouse fast food chain. So that's one example. Don't know if any of those specific things rung true with you at home about what you need to do in your company, but it all stemmed from the thing we've talked about in previous episodes, finding out who their ideal and likely buyers were, and then they identified, how do we get to these ideal and likely buyers? We're going to have to cut costs by 25%. Well, how are we going to do that? We're going to have to do these ginormous major changes. and they pulled it off. Pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
But there's pains involved.
Mm-hmm.
Growth pains involved.
Mm-hmm.
Before we get into the specifics here, go ahead and give us the other one here. Give us the other story here, Marshall. This is the NYPD story, Marshall. The police of New York and Commissioner William Bratton.
Commissioner William Bratton, this is the NYPD story. So Commissioner Bratton assumed his new job after polls taken, said that the citizens of New York were not happy, as so, they never seem to be.
Well, they take a big poll. The citizens of New York aren't happy with the NYPD, and then they're like, and we're hiring William Bratton.
So they wanted reduced crime,
yeah,
both major crime and misdemeanors, such as panhandling, graffiti, urinating in public, crimes that were deemed as adversely affecting the quality of life. Okay. Surveys of police officers disclosed a low level of morale and a perception of police work defined in terms of effort, not results.
So the police officers aren't happy. The citizens aren't happy. Everything's kind of gross.
Yeah.
Okay, keep going.
Bratton believed that the crime could be managed at lower levels, a view not shared by all of the precinct commanders. Those deemed unable to adapt to a strategy aimed at achieving results instead of goals of effort were reassigned to other jobs. Oh, you don't think you can get results? You're going over here.
He said, we're going to change things up. And they said,
no, we're not.
No, we can't do that. It won't work.
Okay. Janitor duty.
All right. Well, you're doing something else now.
Which was significant because of the decision to give precinct commanders more resources and hold them accountable for crime in their respective precincts. So they invested in larger ammunition clips, improved protective vests, and darker blue uniforms that looked more distinguished and authoritative. So ammunition, protective vests, uniforms. They had an extensive survey to get officers previously trained to defend the department to admit there were problems and identify potential areas of improvement. Out of this emerged a massive effort involving 300 members of the department organized into 12 teams to re-engineer an underperforming organization.
So they started making changes, had some consultants come in, do some heavy investigating, and out of it they got, okay, these 300 people are now, in addition to what they're already doing, these 300 people are now on these task force, organized into 12 teams, and we're going to figure this out.
Yep.
Okay.
So check this out. One team found that there were 8,000 forms in active use in the department.
8,000. That's some paperwork.
8,000 forms.
There's 8,000 different forms. And they're like, what? We just realized this.
Another found that officers were on duty during desirable hours, not when crimes were actually being committed.
I would like to be at work from 10 to 4, please, because that's super convenient for me. I realize that crime usually happens at night, but you know what? I'd rather not be there then.
Mm. A third resulted in the introduction of a new video conferencing technology to save 14 hours of overtime associated with the average arrest by making it possible for officers to testify in front of judges without waiting in courtrooms during off-duty hours.
So think about that. Previous to this, they had to, okay, when you're not working, that's when you have to go testify to the judge whenever you arrest somebody. Doesn't that make you want to not arrest people? Doesn't that make you want to be like,
gosh,
I did not see you do that this time. Just please don't do it again.
Just stop
I've got
it.
A lot of stuff coming
just
up this weekend.
Stop it.
I've got a barbecue that I don't want to miss. Please don't rob that man again. I'd really appreciate it if you would not rob that man again.
Yeah.
Okay.
600 practical crime-fighting ideas were proposed by the teams, which were incorporated into six strategies around which the department would organize its efforts. The six strategies were, number one, getting guns off the streets. Number two, curbing youth violence in schools and on streets. Number three, driving drug dealers out of New York. Don't have to go home, just can't stay here. Breaking the cycle of domestic violence, reclaiming the public spaces of New York, and number six, reducing auto-related crime in New York.
So these 300 people on 12 teams came up with 600 ideas, and they boiled them down to six major strategic things they were aiming at.
Yeah.
Those six things.
Yep.
Okay.
So the other major effort concerned the computerization. That's a very technical term, computerization. Organization and rapid reporting of cumulative crime statistics. Computerized maps reported crimes daily. This info gave the info that high crime areas occurred where there were guns, drugs, and people with criminal records. Weird.
They started tracking that stuff and noticed the pattern.
Since these locations could be identified and measured, police resources were reassigned to high crime areas. At the same time, a drive against petty crime in which those committing misdemeanors were stopped, searched, and checked for police records to improve quality of life, but also identify some of those who might be capable of committing more serious crimes. So, in summary, during the first 2 years of Commissioner Bratton's administration, murders in New York City declined by 39%.
39%.
Auto theft.
Murders.
Auto thefts by 36%. And robberies by 31%. Auto thefts and robberies not as significant as murders in your mind?
Well, I mean, I think you get to still, you get another chance if it's not murder. If it's murder, I don't really think you get another chance.
Auto thefts by 36%, robberies by 31%. Misdemeanors also sharply declined, and officers had more pride in being associated with the department.
So these all sound like, in hindsight, these all sound like, oh, obviously, type moves. But when you have an organization that's that big and been doing it for that long, and they're sort of stuck in the same patterns, and they're realizing, we're not hitting the goals we want to hit. What do we need to change?
Mm.
Came up with all the ideas, identify their strategy by implementing those strategies, by changing the way they did things, changing the way they did scheduling, changing the way they did their form reporting, changing the way their, I mean, the twice weekly crime reports that were automatically sent in, that's what the commanders would then meet about. They'd meet about that, and that's how they could identify who was doing well, who wasn't doing well, what they needed to strategically change. And that's what led to a decline in murders by 39%, auto thefts by 36%, robberies by 31%. These all seem like awesome things.
They are.
It's a big win.
Big win.
Were there any pain involved along the way?
A lot of pain.
Ooh. Tell me about the pain.
3 out of 4 precinct commanders were reassigned to other jobs.
Ooh. So almost 25% of you get to keep your jobs.
Mm.
Okay.
Absolute pay levels were reduced in efforts to cut overtime through improved technology. Complaints of excessive force increased by 40%.
So only 1 out of 4 of you are keeping your job, and we're going to pay everybody less. And also you're getting complained about a lot more often.
Mm.
So there's some growth pains there.
Yeah.
But the results were fantastic.
Pros and cons.
Pros and cons.
So,
from the book, Service Profit Chain, change won't take place without stress at other levels in the organization here, Marshall. That sounds like some stress at some other levels.
Yeah.
Read me there in the book, Service Profit Chain. They also talked about Sears as a case study.
Yeah.
Didn't include that for time reasons, but go ahead and read me the quote here by Anthony Rucci, the head of HR at Sears, talking about this.
He says, a compelling place to work does not mean a nice place to work. Ooh. We want people to feel some degree of anxiety, the stress of achievement-oriented people.
So this guy had a pretty high-up position at Sears talking about changing their business. They're saying, yeah, we don't want it to be comfortable. We want everybody to be a little bit like, I got to drive a little. I got to push. I got to achieve.
Freaking out a little bit. A
little bit of stress, a little bit of growth pain.
Mm.
So that's what we're talking about in this series. That was the Taco Bell story and the NYPD story. In the next episode, we are going to get into the stages in organization re-engineering, the specific steps. I'm going to get into the specifics in the next episode here in this training. So this is kind of like one big setup. I mean, I enjoyed this. I mean, this is
Taco cool. Bell. I'm hungry now.
This is cool information, though.
I'm really hungry for a K-.
I don't think that's a food. I think that was what they're referring to there.
You just gotta order it. It's off the menu.
Yeah. Just go in there and be like, I'd like the K-, please. And if they act like they don't know what you're talking about, that means they know exactly what you're
then
talking about.
Then just please pull forward.
And that means you just gotta ask. You gotta keep asking. That's the trick. You gotta keep asking until they give in.
Mm.
That's how you get the
K-. You
gotta
ask 3 times and then they finally give it to you. It's like a knock.
It's like a secret club. the K minus. So Marshall, we talked about some big changes in these organizations, big results, but also resulted in some big growth pain.
Mm-hmm.
Before we, you know, close out this episode, do you feel like you have any insight on this about big change in their organization for the people at home, and while that might be good and it might also feel not so great?
I'll take them back to my middle school days when I was growing a lot.
Wow, yeah.
I grew like 6 inches in a year. And it hurt a lot.
Yeah.
And you know what? I was a better basketball player for it.
Would you take back, would you rather not have had that pain in the middle of school and you'd be like 6 foot now?
No.
Are you sure?
No.
Would you take that pain again right now and then become like 7'3"?
No. Not at all.
Okay.
But if you're going to have change, you're going to have some pain. If you want change, you got to have some pain.
So in the next episode, we're going to talk about the specifics of how to actually do that in your organization and how to pull that off step by step. Okay. That's it for this episode. Marshall, daily wins of the week.
Daily wins.
Daily wins of the week. I need you to announce this, to give us the daily wins of the week, as if you are Anthony Rucci. You're the head of HR at Sears. And based on only this quote, we know nothing about Anthony. Besides this quote, he seems like he rules with an iron fist is what it sounds like. That's all we know.
Oh, the first three ways that I could do it were not, it's not approved that I could do them that way.
Okay.
So we'll go with, we'll just wing it.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, sure. Go for it, Anthony.
So if I'm Anthony, mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So Bill, what we're going to need you to do is, I called you into my office today is because you can't keep going around front hugging people. You got to side hug them. Okay. So if you're going to hug a coworker, you just got to side hug him. The front hugs, you can't just go up to Janet and just like front hug her like that. It's making her uncomfortable. Okay. I know that you're excited about the washers and dryers. I know it's a new sale, but, what I'm going to need you to do is stop front hugging people, or else you're going to have to, you know, this is not going to be a good fit for you long term. And furthermore, if you show up again late or not in dress code, you're fired. Okay. Now go ahead and send in, I'm going to need you to go ahead and send in, Derek. Okay. So Derek, come on in. All right. Thank you, Derek. Now I want to let you know that it's just not working out. You're going to need to go find employment elsewhere. Thank you, Derek. Why can't I work here? You know, it's just not working out, Derek. Thank you. You can go pack up your things and please leave. And also, send in Daniel. Daniel. Okay, Daniel, thank you for coming in today. We got the daily wins of the week.
The character development is what I loved about that. The character development.
There was more character development than...
The stories. You really laid it out there. I don't even know if Bill made it out of the room before you fired Derek. I know you told him to like bring Derek in,
no,
but it seemed
was
kind of like
there.
In passing.
It was it,
like
it was
Bill heard.
Yeah.
Bill knew.
Yeah.
That Derek was getting fired.
Yeah. That was actually not a true story.
Also, the way you said front hug made it sound like the dirtiest thing ever. Like I've never heard of it, of front hugging. I've heard of hugging. And I've heard of side hugging. I've never heard of front hugging. But the way you're saying front hug over and over just sounded like...
You clearly have not worked in corporate America very much, Dan.
I have not worked in corporate America very much. I did not know front hugging was a normal term.
It's a noun.
Really?
If anybody watching this knows of this whimsical thing called a front hug, you email us.
Oh, man. I love it. I love it so much. Okay. Well, go ahead and front hug everybody on camera and give us the daily wins of the week.
Okay, so daily win of the week. On this past 2 days ago, I had a sweet conversation with one of our Thrivers. His name is, and the reason I'm bringing this full circle, is he is Ukrainian. His name is Mikhailo Panchashak.
Oh, Mikhailo.
Yeah, Mikhailo. And so he had a huge win in that one of his deals, $39,000. Okay, $39,000.
Wow.
he calls me up and he goes, you'll never guess what happened. I told you guys about the $39,000 deal. Well, they just tacked on $10,000 worth of more sales and things. I upsold them $10,000. Boom. And he goes, we're going to make so much profit on this. Like, it's awesome. Okay. So the customer's happy. We're happy. We're growing the company. And so this is a guy that literally moved over from Ukraine. Okay. And now is on a mission to provide back for his parents. Okay. Who moved his family out of a very, very tumultuous situation. In Ukraine, and wanted to give their family a better opportunity for life here in the United States. And he is actually growing his business, AmericanHybridHomes.com. They're doing contracting work and energy efficient homes. It is awesome. So go check them out, AmericanHybridHomes.com. But Michaelo, way to kill it.
Great job, Michaelo. If you're up in the New York area, look up that dude. Get some hybrid going on in your home. They also travel. I think they did some stuff in Minnesota. They did some stuff here in Oklahoma. They travel and do some crazy stuff, too.
Yeah.
Great job, Michaelo. Great job. If you don't know what we do, we help grow small businesses in three different ways. One, you can go on Thrive15.com and watch training videos from legendary mentors such as Lee Cockrell, such as Michael Levine, such as the Entrepreneur of the Year from the Small Business Administration, Clay Clark, such as the CEO of Thrive15, Robert Zellner. They're all on there, and you can get started for $1. $1, Marshall. $1 for the first month. Crazy. Get started for $1. Or you can come to one of our two-day conferences. Go ahead and show them, Sam. Go to thrivetimeshow.com/workshops to be part of one of our next workshops here. It's a two-day, 16-hour business extravaganza. The action steps that are coming out of these things are crazy. Like, people are leaving with like full notebooks worth of stuff they got to do when they get back to their business. We just had, 65 people come in this last weekend?
It was awesome.
The building was getting, we're moving desks out of the way to make space for more people. It's still a small atmosphere. It's not like a Tony Robbins sort of thing where you don't get to ask questions or anything because there's so many people. You get one-on-one help that way. Or if you're looking for one-on-one coaching for your business on a weekly basis, we do that with people all over the nation. You can find out more about that on thrive15.com as well. All right, Marshall. That's it for this episode. The next episode, we're going to continue down this path. We're going to get into the stages of organization re-engineering, and we're talking about why growth pain is going to be good for your business.
Hot sizzle.
Hot sizzle. This was the Andre Karolenko episode, episode 47. Over there, slightly looking like Andre Karolenko, Marshall F. Morris. Over here, Daniel McKenna. That has been all for today and the Daily Hustle. Boom!